All right. Hey, how you doing? Welcome to the Other People Show. I'm Brad Listy. It's good to be with you. I hope you're okay. I'm in Los Angeles, and I have for you an excellent program. Melissa Broder is my guest. Her new novel, Milk Fed, is out there now from Scribner. You're going to hear a conversation between me and Melissa Broder in just a moment. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Crossing, publisher of the novel The Ardent Swarm by Yamen Manai. It is the winner of multiple literary awards in France, as well as a Penheim Translation Fund grant. It is critically acclaimed all over the world. The Ardent Swarm is a brilliantly accessible modern-day parable written by a Tunisian-born Parisian resident. Yamen Manai uses a masterful blend of humor and drama to reveal what happens in a country shaken by revolutionary change after the world stops watching. The Ardent Swarm is about a bee whisperer. That's right, a bee whisperer, a beekeeper, a bee expert, a man who understands bees. He lives on the outskirts of a desolate North African village, and he awakes one morning to find that a mysterious swarm of vicious hornets has attacked his beehives, brutally killing every inhabitant. But where do they come from, and how can he stop them? If he is going to unravel this mystery and save his bees, the beekeeper, his name is Sidi, must venture out into the village in search of answers. Out there, he discovers a country and a people turned upside down by their new post-Arab Spring reality, as Islamic fundamentalists seek to influence votes any way they can on the eve of the country's first democratic elections. The Ardent Swarm is out now from Amazon Crossing. Amazon Crossing publishes award-winning and best-selling books from around the world, making international literature accessible to many readers for the first time. You can find out more at apub.com. So for those of you who are new to the Other People podcast, this show is offered freely. It's a weekly show. New episodes drop every Wednesday. Sometimes there are new episodes on Sunday, but always on Wednesday. You can find the show at otherppl.com. You can follow it on Twitter at otherppl. It's also on Instagram. And it also has its own app, the Other People with Brad Listy app. So you can find it wherever you find podcasts. Listen up if you wish. My guest today is, once again, Melissa Broder. Her new novel, Milk Fed, is out there now from Scribner. This is a wonderful book. So enjoyable. Like an unlikely romance. Funny. Like a wistful, painful, moving exploration of desire. A very feminine book. You're going to hear me talk about all of this with Melissa. I've known her for years. We go back, we're old pals, and she's a big talent. So I'm thrilled for her to see her having more publication success. She is on a roll. Her other books include the novel The Pisces, the essay collection So Sad Today, and five poetry collections, including the upcoming collection Super Doom, Selected Poems, which is due out this summer. She's also the author of a poetry collection called Last Sext. And she's the mastermind behind the At So Sad Today Twitter feed, which has over a million followers. So, without any further introduction, let's get to the conversation with Melissa Broder. Her new novel, One More Time, is called Milk Fed.
So when I was in college, I wrote this horrific short story about a woman with an eating disorder who falls in love with a very zoftig woman who has a lot of freedom around food and her body. And it was like the story was like a big piece of shit. Like, it's probably why I just only wrote poetry for the next 10 years. Like, the zoftig woman was named Gaia, and she was like this earth figure. Like, it was a disaster. But I've always wanted to tell this story. And a couple of years ago, I started feeling this nostalgia for like the Jewiness of my childhood. And I couldn't figure out why, because it's like, we live in Los Angeles. It's basically Fiddler on the Roof. Like, there's no shortage of Jews here. you know? But I couldn't figure out, well, what was this nostalgia? Why was I feeling this longing? And what I realized was that what I felt the longing for was like when my grandparents used to take me to the delis in New York, and I felt like a little precious, innocent treasure. One of the only times in my childhood when I felt that sense of innocence and like a treasure. And I started to think about my relationship with food and my relationship with spirituality and the ways that those appetites, the appetite for the divine and the appetite for food, and then also sexual desire, the ways they're all interconnected. And that's how the Jewish element made its way in, and I started writing the story.
Okay. So the story that you're telling is a kind of unlikely love story between two women, just for people who haven't read. So there's Rachel, who's the protagonist. She's like a 24-year-old, I believe, young comedian in Los Angeles. And then there's Miriam Schwebel, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, who is...
I love just hearing you pronounce it. That was so cute.
Yeah, she's like an Orthodox Jewish. I mean, you can describe. She's your character. Like Miriam would be the Zaftig character, but
Zaftig. She's a kosher coquette. She's so hot. You know, to me, she's so hot. She's like very voluptuous. Like, okay, I'll tell you what. Like, she wears like she wears like a long like psychedelic patterned dress that is like fully like. Under Orthodox custom in the sense that it covers her to the wrist and to the ankle, but like you can see all of her curves in this beautiful dress. So it's like, you know, it's like it's like Jacob and the Technicolor frozen yogurt dream cut. So Rachel works at Miriam works at Rachel's frozen yogurt shop.
And Rachel is, just because we got to make sure that people listening who have not read understand the dichotomy here, like Rachel is food obsessive, eating disordered, obsessed with being skinny.
She's like Our Lady of Body Dysmorphia.
Yeah. And then you have Miriam, who like kind of doesn't have a care in the world and is sort of like happily embodied.
In that regard.
Yeah. Like she just...
She is free in the ways that Rachel is not free.
There we go.
So at first, Rachel perceives her as completely free, you know? Who among us is completely free? I don't know that any of us are completely free, but Rachel perceives Miriam as completely free because Miriam is free in the way that Rachel is not free, which is very in touch with her hunger and okay with it.
Okay. So here's a question I have. Have you ever met anybody like Miriam? Like I was struggling to decide, cause I love the character and, I fell, you know, she's easy to fall in love with. But at the same time, I was like, is this a fairy tale? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, are there people in the world who have this relationship with themselves? Which is like, I feel like there's something really like ultra healthy about it. And also this relationship with food, like just enjoy food and don't think about the consequences of how it's going to affect your weight or your health. Like, I wonder if I know anybody like this. Like, do you know women like this or people like this?
Well, here's what I'll say, rather than talking about reality. What I'll say is that we see Miriam through Rachel's eyes. We don't see Miriam through Miriam's own eyes. We see, you know, right? Like every encounter we have with Miriam is through Rachel's perspective. And, you know, and what I will say is like, how real is anyone we ever fall in love with? How flawless or free? Especially in those early days of that narcotic limerence, right? Like with the Pisces, a lot of people ask, well, is Theo the merman real? And I was always like, well, how real is anyone we fall in love with? And I feel that in some ways the same could be said about Miriam's healthy attitude toward food and joie de vie. Have I met people who have that freedom and delight with indulgence? Yes. Have I met women who have that freedom and delight with indulgence? Yes. But I have not met any Miriams.
Yeah. I mean, I got to say, like, I was evaluating my own relationship with food as I was reading this book. I think it's kind of inevitable.
Well, you are no Miriam. I mean, let's put it on the table. You're more Rachel than Miriam. That's... You're not a Rachel.
Right.
But if we had to, you're more Rachel than Miriam.
Well, see, this is the thing. Like, I was trying to figure out, because I'm a vegan for the most part. Like, but I'm not
come on, you're vegan.
Yeah, but if someone puts a piece of chocolate in front of me, I'm not going to be like, is there almond milk in this chocolate? Like, and I also wear leather shoes sometimes. So, like, you know, you got to define vegan in terms of how, like, rigorous you're going to be about it. But I would say, like, 95% of what I eat is animal free. Okay. Maybe even a little bit more, but, you know, not perfect, but close. On that metric. And so, like, I struggle with this. Like, I don't want to seem or be, like, too rigid and crazy. And I ask myself, like, why I do this? Like, why am I doing this? Is this, like, kind of austerity, like some kind of self-punishment? Is it born of some, like, self-esteem thing? Or am I making, like, a rational decision based on a confluence of factors? I don't know.
Well, the Listies are Catholics, right?
Yes, yes.
The Listies are all right. So you're coming from a Catholic origin. Not to boil this all down to religion, because it's not. However, knowing you fairly well, having eaten many a meal with you,
right?
I would say, okay. Do you want me to? I think that you, if you fell into any category, it would probably be more of like the orthorexic, which is like. Very like the health and goodness. Like I always say Brad is one of the best citizens that I know. No, it's true. Like, and it's like, you know, you want your daughter to marry Brad. Like you just do.
I don't know about that. Talk to my wife about that.
I feel to me, you're a good citizen of the world. You know, you can recommend an umbrella and like, I will believe in that like choice, you know, and like your veganism, my own eating of animal carcasses is something that I don't like about myself. And yet, you know, I'm still like behind the wheel of the car, like with a fucking I'm a beef jerky girl. I am. And so I'm eating death like often. And so I really respect that about you. But I would say it's more of an orthorexia.
Wait, what is orthorexia?
Orthorexia is, let's Google. It's like a focus on health, but to an extent, like, you know, when there's somebody who like, you know, when you have that friend who some people run a marathon cause they just like it, which I don't really understand. But then there's like, I have a lot of friends who like, are like, I'm running the marathon. And I'm like, dude, this is like the worst idea for you. Like, this is just your eating disorder and body dysmorphia, like under a mantle, you know what
right.
I'm saying? Like given. And so it's sort of a real focus on like the health perspective, but sometimes with a bit of a tainted, or like you can use it to beat yourself up, you know, like I'd say if you trended in any direction, it would be, I'm not saying you're orthorexic, but it would be more in that direction rather than like bulimia, right? Like your star is not, your compass is not pointed that direction.
You know what I'm doing lately? Like I've been doing this for a long time now, is I do intermittent fasting. I only eat two meals a day.
That's very ortho, because it's like, you know, it's like Goop says it's a good idea.
Yeah, or just like, or...
It's like part of the self, it's like things, I would define orthorexia as like things you can do as part of the self-love industrial complex that are like grandfathered in as good, but it depends who you are as to whether it's good or not and to what extent you take it. Like for some people, fasting is probably great. For others who have a more punishing relationship to themselves, right? Like these things are not equal. It's like when I go to before we were in quarantine, like I would go to a spin class and they're like, remember why you came here, like give yourself a pat on the back, like remember why you're here. And I'm like, I'm here because I fucking hate myself and can't leave myself alone. Like it's not good that I'm here, you know. Or like I had this therapist who I like showed up and I had just been like running in like the 85 degree heat. And she's like, that's great that you move your body. And I'm like, it is like really not great. In fact, like, you know, but for some people it would be great.
Right.
Not for me.
Yeah. I think
so
that
intent.
I think that I'm like 45 now. I have to kind of, I often have to get up in the night to pee. I'm at that age now. Like things are changing.
How many times are you getting up a night to pee, would you say, on average?
Zero to one. It depends on the night. Like some nights I just tough it out, but I usually have to, I could pee.
That's child's play.
That's, yeah.
I don't care about your zero to one bullshit.
Okay, but here's my point. And
three.
Tell me, you know,
talking like 2 to 3 here. Okay.
Are you 2 to 3?
Oh, I'm 2 to 3.
Okay. Well, I'm
upwards of 2 to 3.
I did not formerly have to do that. So I'm noticing myself aging. Like I'm noticing at my mid 40s is the first time I've really felt differences in my body. And something that I realized is that like I was kind of getting annoyed by this like kind of arbitrary, like you got to eat 3 meals a day. Like I got to have my breakfast and then I got to have my, I'm like, I'm not actually fucking hungry because my metabolism is slowing down. Like it's too much food and it's, I don't need it. Like my body doesn't need this much. And I tried to just cut breakfast out. And by the time I get to lunch, like I'm genuinely hungry and I eat whatever I want. You know, I don't eat any meat, but I eat whatever I want. And then I eat dinner.
What's your typical lunch?
It depends. Like I'll have...
You haven't had lunch yet today, right?
No. So I'll have soup, salad, toast, or I'll have like...
What kind of soup?
These great soups from Erewhon. It's like the most LA thing to say. But, you know, they have these like pre-made like green soups and lentil soups that are just like... They come in like mason jars or not mason jars.
Would you do like a soup and a salad?
Sure, yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's a delicious lunch.
So nice. Wow.
But no, like I like to think I'm being logical. And I think like too, like really and truly, who decided we need 3 meals a day? Did the cavemen need 3 meals a day? You ate when you fucking caught some food or killed something. I mean, it's lovely if that's what you want to do. But if I'm only hungry twice a day, like truly hungry, then that's okay too, I would think, right? And it makes sense.
Do you have snacks?
Yeah, after my lunch, like I eat whatever I want from like 1:30.
What you want when what you want is like a delicious vegan soup and a salad, like great. Like I tried to do intuitive eating once. Okay, all right. Let me just back up here for a second. I don't mean to cut you off.
No, please.
And I don't mean to compare and despair because we are all God's children.
That's
however,
right.
I just want to give you a little glimpse. All right. So my oldest relationship, my longest relationship is my fucked up relationship with food in my body. Okay. Started very young. And I've been through every incarnation. I was never a vomit bulimic, but simply because once my stomach gets a hold of something, it does not let go. But I was a laxatives girl. Which is a fucking disaster. But that was, so I've been through like every incarnation, right? Like high school, I was anorexic. I've had like really frightening bouts of binge eating, like disorder. I've had like the whole nine, right? And so, so one time I tried to do intuitive eating.
What is that?
It's like kind of what you do. It's like giving your body what it craves. Okay, my body... First of all, like, and I have had my body on silence for so, like, I've had it on, like vibrate mode. Like, I've had my appetite on vibrate mode for, like, so long. So when I turn it on, or it's like, it's been off.
Right.
So when I turn it on, it's like 50 texts come flooding in. You know, it's just like, feed me. And so when I tried to do intuitive eating, it just ended in, like, it was like a fucking bender. It was like dozen donut. Like, it went.
Crazy.
So. I will just say that I think it's beautiful that you eat whatever you want, but it seems that your wants are like good.
Well, yeah, because I have this, like, I'm one of these people where I'm like, food
like
is life fuel.
Sustaining. Yeah.
Food is fuel.
Food
like to
is
me, that
fuel.
That's my practical, like, and don't get me wrong. Like,
no, that's lovely.
I like to have a glass of wine. I will have a cocktail. I love dessert. I have a sweet tooth. I eat dessert every day. Whether it's like a bowl of dairy-free ice cream or...
But see, Brad, this is the fundamental difference for us, right? Like,
yeah.
you love a nice glass of wine, a nice dessert. Yeah. Like, I want to be out of my goddamn... Like, nice glass of wine. Somebody the other day was tweeting about like a cocktail. I'm like, never in my life did I have a cocktail. Like, I want out. I'm like, give me two tickets to like Blackoutville. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I want to be like dead and not feel it happening. You know, like that's what I, you know, and so we're coming, we approach it from different places, you know, but so, yeah.
But we both think about it a lot. Like, that's the thing. Like, you and I have, and I think we've had a dialogue, like, off, you know, outside of the context of this show or whatever, like, in our friend lunches and just over the years talking. Like, we've talked about food before. It's not, like, I think as a guy, maybe of a certain type, like, cis, male, you know what I'm saying? Like, not all guys my age who fit my profile are vegan, and they certainly don't sit around thinking about food maybe as much as I do. So I've got a bit of it, you know. I don't think I'm one of these dudes who's just like, give me like a turkey leg and a beer, you know.
Hashtag not all men.
Yeah. So
no, I mean, I feel like you do have a consciousness, and you bring that consciousness though to every area of your life, I think. I mean, you know, that's, I mean, not to toot your horn, but like I said, you're a good global citizen.
Well, you just, like, what you put in your body has like ecological, like, this is, I don't want to make this all about me being a vegan, because I don't care.
No, I like that. I like it.
I don't care. I'm not a proselytizer, but people often ask you. And what I always say, like it's exhausting to try to figure out what to eat because it always changes. It's like, be a paleo. Eat like a caveman. What? You're eating grains? Then you're going to have grain brain. What? You're not eating whole grains? Oh my God. Your like lack of fiber is going to make you die. You know, it's constantly changing. So there's never really any way to nail down what the perfect diet is. I think it differs from person to person. And I also get that people will be like, oh, you're a vegan? Oh, but you feed your dog like ground up salmon. So like, you're not so holy and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, that's true. I don't think it's possible to be perfect from a moral perspective in terms of how you approach food. And I don't do it for that reason or with that idea. I think for me, it's like a confluence of the ecology. You know, I think it's better for the earth if people aren't eating so much meat. My body responds well to it. Maybe not everybody's does, but I don't need meat. Like, I'm fine. I've been without it since I was 20. And then I'm trying to think of what else it would be. It's like the ecology, the economics of it.
Those are two pretty good reasons.
Yeah. And so it's like, and I also, I think mostly I just need to be done. I can't think about it too much. I want to settle on something that feels reasonably good and responsible and then just like get on with my life because I'm too reactive to all of this stuff. Like, if there's a story on the internet about health related shit, I am a sucker for it and it fucks with my head. You know, I'll click through and read about it and it'll be like, oh my God, like I drink red wine, I think, because somebody told me that it's good for your heart on the internet once, you know, it's like that kind of thing.
As an alcoholic, I mean, like, that just makes me fucking die of laughter. I'm laughing inside. You don't hear me, but I'm laughing.
So I want to ask you about like my perception of your book, or like one of my perceptions of your book. Knowing you a little bit, is that I feel like in Milkfed, you are in exercising like wish fulfillment in a lot of different ways. Like, in some sense, I was thinking to myself, like, this is like the world, or this is a world like truly built according to, Melissa's wishes. Like, you built a kind of dream world. I guess every novelist is doing that, but you know, I think of it from a food perspective. Like, you created this character Miriam who gets to sort of be and behave in ways that I think you might wish you could or would. I think in terms of like, you know, relationship to body, you know, to have, even if it's from Rachel's perspective, it might not be exactly how Miriam feels, but you know, through in Rachel's eyes, like, this is a person who has a freedom and a sense of liberation that she wishes she could have. And then, I also felt like there was gender wish fulfillment. Like, this is a very feminine, like, defiantly feminine book, in a cool way. And men do not make out well in this story.
I feel like Mr. Schwebel is the only like redeemable male in the book. And
that's interesting. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm like, you know, Jace, you know, like, he's kind of a nice guy, but he's sort of a douche. He's like,
yeah,
the...
he wears multiple bracelets. He looks like he's about to go fight in it. Jace is an actor character who Rachel is forced to contend with, who, like, you know, he to describe Jace, he's the kind of man who's always wearing a fedora, even if he's not wearing a fedora.
So, you know, but then there's also age. Like, Rachel's 24. She's like at that great sweet moment of like young adulthood when you have like maximum freedom, you know, maximal freedom. So I could just feel you have it. Like, that would be a fun world for you to play in, I feel like. And it would allow you to sort of, it's like you created a laboratory, like certain parameters for your laboratory, and then you got to play around inside of it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I feel like this book definitely was like from the soul. You know what I'm saying? Like, it came from the soul. And also, too, there's magic,
right?
Like, there's the mysticism. I mean, yeah, it's all my great loves. There's like a magic Chinese restaurant where you get like this poo-poo platter of delight. I mean, and then you get fingered under the table. I mean, like, what more? Yes, Brad, yes. Yeah. No,
You're speaking of the Golden Dragon in the
Golden
book.
Dragon, my dream, which the Golden Dragon is a Chinese restaurant that it's a Chinese American restaurant. It's like Polynesian vibes, you know? It's like a Chinese, it's kind of like tiki vibes Chinese restaurant.
Does it exist in real life?
Well, not at all. There actually is a restaurant in Los Angeles called the Golden Dragon, which I didn't know. And then the fact checker was like, do you want to change the name of your restaurant? And I was like, no, because they didn't want it to be like the wrong Golden Dragon. I don't know. You know, the fact checker is kind of like a traffic cop. Like, they have to like, which I respect, but they, you know, they have to like get a certain, they have to find a certain, create a certain amount of like, you know, tickets for each round of like reading through the thing. But so, or proofreader or whatever. But so the Golden Dragon is inspired by like my, when I was in college, I used to go in Davis Square, Massachusetts. I went to Tufts University, which a lot of people think is in New Jersey, but it's in Massachusetts. And I would go to this place called Yee's Cocktail Lounge or Yee's Village and Cocktail Lounge. And it was a little slice of fucking heaven. Okay. They had all the tiki drinks, you know, they had all the scorpion bowls, and then they had like really shitty Chinese food, but like delicious, like really greasy mushu and things like that. So the Golden Dragon, I think, takes some pages from Yee's, which no longer exists. And also from, in the book Marjorie Morningstar, there is a scene at a Chinese restaurant that has, it's like a magical sort of mid-century Chinese American vibe from that, and then also from my imagination. So I'd say it's sort of a hybrid. It's a hybrid fantasy.
Yeah, and I think I forgot to mention too, like another part of like, you know, like speaking of wish fulfillment or playing with this idea of liberation and indulgence. You know, those scenes in the Chinese restaurant, like, they're so decadent. Like, there's so much food coming to the table. These drinks that Rachel and Miriam are drinking are like the size of fish bowls, which I have to imagine, as somebody who's sober for a long time, you must have had fun with that, right? Like, just...
Well, it's always funny that, like, because my two female protagonists aren't alcoholics. And I'm always, it's always interesting because I'm just like, oh, she just enjoys a nice drink, you know? So I can't give my characters all my problems. You know, they can maybe each take on, like, you know, they can each take on one to two. But, you know, they can't have the full buffet. So, yeah, I limit that. But, yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it's just deliciousness, you know? It's like fucking Polynesian punch and daiquiris and all this crazy-ass shit and the Dragon Balls and the Blue Hawaiian. I mean, I love all that, like, mid-century Hollywood retro kitsch tiki nostalgia. Like, I love that stuff. So that was really fun to put in there. Also, like, the abundance of food and that the food is really delicious, even though it's a kosher restaurant, because kosher Chinese can be hit or miss, you know, kosher food can be hit or miss, but that it's delicious. And then we've got a Golden Dragon like squirting steam, we've got neon lights. I mean, it's everything I really, that is the universe I want to live at the Golden Dragon.
That's it. And I feel like, too, like you had so much fun writing. Like, there's great food writing in this book. Like, it's very sensual. Like, how do I even describe this? But, like, you know, you can taste the food. Like, you're really going into it almost like you're writing. It's like Ruth Reichel or something. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you really indulge. And it's a natural creative choice because the book is so much about food and indulgence and consumption, you know? And so
disordered eater's Ruth Reichel. Yeah. Like, I'm the Ruth Reichel who I'm going to take you to 7-Eleven and we're going to get to go on a bender, but it's going to be at 7-Eleven. You know, it's going to be like the microwavable, like Chef Boyardee. It's going to be, you know, the Hostess cupcake. Like, I'm like a down market Ruth Reichel.
Well, I want to talk to you. Okay, so this is a natural place to ask you about this because I've noticed in our many lunches over the years, and you know, we'd sit down at a table, like we'll go to some vegetarian restaurant or something, and I never recall noticing like you'd order something. Usually, I guess a salad, but then I also remember you often talking, and this is kind of reflected in the book about loving prepackaged foods that are like contained, and so you know that they have like a calorie count listed on them. Basically, it takes all the guesswork out.
Love.
That's it.
I'm a lot like Rachel. So the character of Rachel had like what was like a pronounced eating disorder in high school, right? Like what could be diagnosed as anorexia, right? Like she like stopped getting her period. She grew fur. You know, she was always freezing. Like she restricted to the point of like physical harm to self. When she recovers, quote unquote, because I feel like when she recovers, she's sent to a nutritionist and the nutritionist starts to add calories back to her diet in a very mathematical way. Because as an anorexic, Rachel was very sure of exactly how many calories she was getting. So mathematically, Rachel does add back those calories. She gets her period back. She doesn't grow. She doesn't have fur anymore. She's not, she doesn't have to like stay in the bathtub for 3 hours because she's so cold. So like scientifically or mathematically or health-wise, one could say that she has recovered. However, the math, the thought processes, the ways of reducing the world into a mathematical equation, which is I think eating disorders are like a religion, right? It's a way of organizing existential doubt. It's a worldview. It's a way of organizing and feeling like you have some control over an otherwise random world. That did not go away for Rachel. And, and I think it's interesting too, just especially, you know, I was talking about the self-love industrial complex. I think a lot of times there are modalities of like, there's a vision of like recovery, let's say in food related stuff where it's like, or just in general, you know, like you get well or you arrive at some place of like resolution, right? And my experience is that it's actually like a daily thing because you're confronted with food every day, right? It's not like food issues are not like alcoholism. Like you can live without alcohol, you know, for your whole life. You can't, you have to eat. Same with love issues. We encounter human beings every day. So it's different. And I think that to paint it as a journey of, as like a place where there's a final destination or a sense of completion would be not the whole story in my experience, you know, that rather it is an ongoing flux and like a navigation of one's relationship. And there are certain people ask like, well, where'd you do your research on eating disorders? And I'm like, honey, I have a fucking PhD. Like, do you know how much information? Like, I don't even remember like what the date of the Revolutionary War is, but I can tell you like how many calories are in like a triangle of Subway cheese. You know what I'm saying? Like the amount of useless information.
Right.
Stored.
Right.
I like can't do shit on Jeopardy, but like take me to Panda Express and I'll tell you like every fucking, like from the egg roll to like the teriyaki chicken, what's going on?
Do you think about health? I mean, cause like if you're eating like protein bars, I guess they're okay. Yeah, I guess you could survive on them, but they're not, like, or, you know, Panda Express or going to 7-Eleven and buying a bunch of prepackaged foods. Like, that stuff is processed and isn't necessarily super healthy. Does that factor in, or it's a calorie count?
Not even at all. Not health. I hate to say it. But I have a very, like, early 2000s Snackwells diet junk food trash diet. My, like, I mean, look, I'm sitting here. Look what's on my nightstand. I've got Nicorette chewed up. I've got Coke Zero.
Uh-huh.
Okay. This is like, for lunch, you know, I'll have some yogurt because I like a lot of protein, but I'll have like cereal and then a bunch of Splenda dumped in that shit. Like cancer, I just pretend it doesn't, I just pretend that the fake sweetener, cancer link, like, I'm like, doesn't apply, you know, doesn't.
But here's the thing. I feel like I'm like much more careful about like eating like, you know, whole foods and putting things being orthorexic and putting things that are from the earth in my body. And I'm going to croak, you know, long before you. You're going to live to be like 120 with all this Splenda in your body.
I don't know. I mean, but I'm definitely not what you'd call farm to table. Let's put it that way. I'm like trash can to table. You're very farm to table, you know?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I like shit in wrappers, you know, like I like my, I don't know how to cook. Everything I eat is microwaved. I mean, it all goes under that like weird light. You know, it's just, no, my diet is disgusting actually. Like it, from a health perspective, it's not great. But from a, okay. I think about this a lot. So, like in the 60s, they didn't have like fake cakes, you know what I'm saying? Or like low-cal ice cream. They like, you either ate the real thing or you didn't have it. And now we have this whole world of like fake foods that like technically to someone who loves themselves probably does taste like a sponge with chocolate spray painted on it. But to me, who lacks that self-love, feels like just the biggest party.
Yeah, included.
Yeah. Seasoned with a lack of self-respect.
I think, like, you know, people like will mock me because I'll be like eating like, you know, my dairy-free ice cream or, but like what I always argue is that I wouldn't know the difference. I mean, I guess if I really sat there and tasted the two, like regular ice cream, delicious, but it hurts my stomach. I'm lactose intolerant.
Oh.
Like dairy-free ice cream, also delicious. Like, I don't think it's like that. Like, why is cow milk really that critical? I guess to some people it is. Like, the taste and the flavor is just, you know. But I'm not that wrapped up in it. To me, it's just like, oh, it's sweet. It's cold. It's delicious. It's a nice little treat at the end of the day. You know, the same thing is true for, like, I love, like, vegan meats. Like, people be like,
vegan meats are good.
No, like,
delicious.
I was talking to Megan Boyle about this. I don't know if it was on the show or if it was like while we were like getting ready for the show, but we were laughing about our love of these vegan sausages that are called, what are they called? I'm forgetting the brand name, but they're fucking delicious. I love them.
And vegan sausages.
I don't know the difference. Like, I guess if you put down an actual, like, you know, pig sausage.
Bloody.
It would
with
be different.
Ghosts.
Maybe it would have like more, like maybe it would be more savory and flavorful, but you know, I don't know. I'm very capable of being like perfectly happy with like the fake thing. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, do you really need to have the 100% calorie version of cake? You can have the diet cake version. It's still delicious, right?
Well, I think a human being who like, you know, doesn't reduce their self-worth into like they'd be like, yes, like I like the taste of also, but you have to think about this too. I mean, you haven't had a real sausage in like 20 years.
It's been a while.
Yeah, so you know, the suffering gives it a lot of flavor. The animal suffering really lends it a certain je ne sais quoi.
But
I get what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, that's how I am with like, I'm like, if I can eat this chocolate flavored sponge for 100 calories, why would I have the 500 cal? But I think not everyone is like, you know, there are some people who like fucking feel very passionately about bacon and are like, would not be willing to do what you're doing. And, you know, and there's some people who I think why would you have the weird ass substitute when you can have like the real thing, you know, with the, with these weird ass like diet muffin tops that I eat. I mean, my diet's very strange. Also, here's the other thing. You are receptive to pain in your body, right? You're like, I'm lactose intolerant. The amount of like fart causing foods that like literally like the amount of like weird fake fibers and fake sugars that I eat, like zero respect for my body, you know, zero respect, I guess, for anyone around me. I mean, yeah.
I was thinking like about people loving bacon. And how many times over the years I've had people tell me, like, I just can't give up bacon. Because bacon's, like, the indulgent meat. It's, like, so delicious. I just want to say, for the record, and I think I've probably said this before, I think bacon is delicious. Like, I think people sometimes think of people who have maybe, like, a more austere diet or whatever you want to call it, like me, that we somehow don't, like, we're so repulsed by the by meat that we just think it's disgusting. Like, I actually think it tastes great.
Yeah.
I just like, I can't get past the animal thing, you know?
That's beautiful.
Okay.
But that's beautiful. You know what I'm saying? That's a bit of a sacrifice. You know, you're making a choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love that though. I mean, Nikki, so I was vegan and vegetarian at various points for like a while of my periods of my life. And I kind of flitted in and out, but there would be like 2 or 3 years where I was vegan, right? And then I would like relapse. And so, my husband's Uncle Frank from Staten Island.
Nikki's my dad's name is Frank.
It's very, I mean, you, the Italians, there's just like, everyone's either a Frank or a Tony, right?
Right.
I didn't know any Frank or Tonys, and now I know like 50 of them, once I met Nikki. Like so many Franks and Tonys. I also had never been to so many hospital beds or funerals.
Yeah, yeah.
You guys really know how to bring like the operatic like drama, like the life, the death, the illness.
Yeah, yeah.
You show up.
My grandfather, now, you know, long deceased, was a butcher. Frank was a butcher.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
He and his Italian brothers, who were first generation Sicilians, had a butcher shop called the Listy Meat Market. In a small town in South Louisiana, down in the swamp.
I think you should rename this podcast the Listy Meat Market.
I had a t-shirt made that said the Listy Meat Market on it for my dad one Father's Day, like just as a joke. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, no,
it's still exist?
Maybe like at the bottom of one of his drawers or something, you know, but I, you know, it wasn't the greatest. It was like one of those like felt letterings, you know, like it wasn't like silkscreen properly. So maybe he trashed it. I don't know.
Oh, felt was so good.
Yeah. That was old school.
So I told Nikki's Uncle Frank, like we were at a Chinese restaurant and he's like, you don't want this? And I'm like, no, I'm vegan. I was vegan at the time. And he's like, what do you mean you're vegan? You don't eat meat, not even ribs. And it's just so funny to me that it would be like somebody would be vegan, but they break for ribs.
No. I've had that conversation like with my Southern, I mean, in the South, a vegan in Louisiana. Are you kidding me? Like in my family, I am considered just a screwball lunatic, you know, because there's all that seafood and the fried food and nobody, like talk about a place that indulges and doesn't necessarily give a fuck about like what the ancillary consequences might be. You know, it's really truly about the sensual experience of eating. How does it taste? If it tastes good, it's good. You know, go get yourself a fried shrimp po' boy or whatever it is. And you know, so for me, going down to the South, I will say this: that is the one place where I will eat seafood simply because I'm usually staying with family or I'm with family, and I have a policy that if I'm staying with somebody, if I'm their guest and they serve me something, I'll eat it. I can't stand the idea of asking somebody to make me a special meal because of my particular diet. You know, I just feel like when I'm a guest in your house, like if you put something in front of me, I'll eat it. And plus, amazing. Plus I like the taste. Like I like seafood, you know, like it's not that I don't like how it tastes. I just, I think of the fish, like wiggling, and you know all that kind of stuff. But anyway, I get the whole Uncle Frank like scene. I totally know that conversation.
That's why, yeah. The past pescatarians are funny. I'm like, oh, so you're like prejudiced against fish? Like, it's like, well, the chicken, it like should live. However, that's also why when people are like, yeah, like in certain countries they eat dogs. I'm like, well, you eat fucking cows. Like, I don't know. I don't know that I discriminate, you know? Like, I think I'm equally, I mean, I don't know that I'd want like dog jerky per se on a personal level, but like theoretically, it's kind of all part and parcel of the same kingdom.
Well, yeah, and you can reverse that argument, you know, because people are like, whoa, you know, meat is blah, blah. And I'm like, but you would not eat your dog, would you? And they go, no. Yeah. And I'm like, but you'll eat a pig, which is more intelligent than your dog. Aww. So like, how are we like parsing this? Do you know what I'm saying? It's just cultural. Like, it just happens to be the case that like, it's considered like a crime to eat a dog in America. But if you're in, you know, somewhere in Asia and somebody serves you dog jerky, it would be like, yeah, you know, no big deal. They sell it everywhere. Totally. So I want to ask you about anger and revenge, which I don't know if anyone's ever asked you this about this book or if it even entered your mind when you were writing it. But like, is there any emotional component to the genesis of the idea and then, you know, the execution on the page that has to do, you think, with like anger at the world, anger at food, anger at the constraints that humans have to live under or that they force themselves to live under? Like, did you feel a sense of like having some kind of like artistic vengeance over food? Do you know what I'm saying?
Interesting. That's a really good question. Well, I do know like anger is definitely a feeling that I don't permit myself a lot. Like, I feel like I don't have enough self-esteem to be angry because I usually turn everything inward. Like, I'm more homicidal or more suicidal than homicidal because I don't feel like I have the self-esteem to be homicidal. So I will say that, number one, I mean, everyone, all humans have anger, right? It's like one of the primary emotions. Like, we all experience anger. We all experience envy, joy, sadness. But it's not one, I think, just in the same vein of being detached from one's appetites or repressing one's sexual appetites or the felt, right? You can perform sexuality. You can be like, you know, I mean, you can fake a million orgasms or you can like look like somebody in a porn, but like you might not be feeling any of it. So I think there's a difference between the felt and the performed. But so with anger is something that I think I'm scared of in myself. I don't know if I fully permit. I think I've also heard that I think depression is a disease. However, I've heard, and maybe it's, you know, part and parcel, that depression is anger turned inward. And I would say in my case, that's probably true. Like the sort of shamey self-hatred feelings, those are probably anger that's sort of mushed down. But, you know, I definitely, it's a really good question. And I don't know. I would have to think about that.
Well, I think, like, I'll give you an example in the book. You know, we talked a little bit about gender and the male characters that you've rendered in the book. And there aren't that many characters in the book. Like, one of the things I admire about it is how artfully constructed it is. Like, you really do have these like set pieces. You have the office environment, you have the apartments, you have the "this show sucks" like comedy club. There's the Golden Dragon. You know what I'm saying? There's a limited like constellation of places that the characters venture to and where the entire story unfolds. And likewise, you know, you have a set number of male characters who embody some things that are like ripe for satire. And I think you and I can both relate, you know, like the manager bro, like Hollywood manager bro. Like, it's a, you know, it's a very recognizable type to me. It's, you know, it's rooted in truth, you know, and
deeply.
And then also like the actor bro, you know, like that guy, you know, the way you describe him, like he's got like the undercut, which is like the hairstyle of the day for like the Hollywood actor bro. And it's like, how do you describe it? It's like it's like Nazi on the sides, like
and like a skyward floof on the top.
Yeah, yeah. And
which, by the way, I mean, I love like. I think I am seeking revenge on that haircut because that haircut gets me. Like, you put that haircut on like a tree, and I want to have sex with that tree. Like, I am a fucking I am a like basic ass bitch for that haircut.
I love that.
I wish
I could do it, but my hairline, I'm too old.
You're kind of moving towards it though. It's like
you're
pointing in that direction.
Vaguely, but it doesn't work for me. You need to have different kind of hair, and you need to have like that flat like hairline, you know, like the straight
TikToker.
Yeah. But I mean, I felt like, you know, you're sending up these guys. I could feel like I could feel female like anger at living and working within a male dominated like patriarchal system. I could feel some of that, and I don't know, I mean, I guess it's natural, but it's also like you know, the satire, like you're skewering these characters, and deservedly, you know what I'm saying? Like it's a proportionate satire, but I just like I couldn't tell how much of it was just like a natural outflow of your creative and storytelling process, like understanding this world, and how much of it was like maybe like a preconceived idea that you wanted to integrate into the book. Like, was this part of the conceit? Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, I think there's probably like a rich history of like literary writers or book writers, like coming to Hollywood, or like, I mean, I didn't move here to become a screenwriter. I moved here because my husband's health, but it's sort of like within it, it just sort of like, well, you and I were a big part of that. You know, you were like, why don't you make So Sad Today something? I'm like, what do you mean? It is something. It's a Twitter. And you're like, no, make it a show. And that was how, you know, that was how my whole thing started. If you hadn't suggested that, I would probably wouldn't be doing.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So it's your fault. And if we hadn't been working together, but, you know, I think there is like a rich history of people just writing a book is so solitary. Hollywood, it's the opposite, right? There's so many chefs. And with every chef, with every human, there's such ripe potential for stupidity. And there's a truck on my block. Is that picking up on the microphone?
It's all good.
Okay. I'm like, sorry, there's a truck. It's really fun to make fun of. And my new favorite element of Hollywood and the world that I think is silly is like the commercialization and the clickbaitization of feminism and social justice. Like, I fucking, like, social justice and feminism as a product, as a marketable product. I love it. I find it hilarious. I felt like it really started with feminism. You know, I call it McFeminism, like a big feminism, right? Like, you know, like the Ruth Bader Ginsburg tote bag of the world, you know, that kind of thing. And it's like, it's just so silly and it's so American, right? To feel like I'm doing something, you know,
because I made this consumer choice or.
Yes, or like, exactly. Or because I use certain language. So I knew that I would be able to get away with making fun of this, monetization and corporatization of feminism and also to some extent social justice issues if I chose this white brow. I also had a lot of inspiration because like a lot of my managers and stuff have been these white bros, right? And so I was like, let's go, you know? And I'm like, he's bald. He's a former frat bro. He's got a fleck of veal meatball on his lip, and he's talking about privilege because he just had twin daughters, and now he thinks he's a feminist. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's delicious.
Yeah, it's all right there.
Yeah, so I think it's more, I think less anger and more I feel perplexed. I feel baffled. I feel perplexed that I'm like, do others not see that, like, some of the disingenuousness of turning feminism into a product? And, like, it's fine. Like, that's fine. I'm not, like, feminism's guardian or anything. But I'm like, let's at least, like, acknowledge the silliness.
Well, and also, like, you know, for somebody who's so immersed and successful on social media, you know, you talked about So Sad Today, but for people who might, for the four people who don't know, like, you've been tweeting, like, you know, several times a day from that account for, what is it now, a decade or maybe
almost
a decade, and you have what, over 1 million followers probably?
Yeah, it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
Like, I wish that I wasn't, but
well, but I mean, hey, that's like
to the dopamine. It's like you have a choice. Two roads diverge in a wood. You feel a feeling. You can either A, sit with the feeling, process the feeling, or B, you can like make something funny about it and tweet it and get dopamine. Like,
okay, so I want to ask. I meant to ask you about this later, but since it came up, I'll ask you about it now. I think the first question, the basic question, is a compositional question because you're so prolific on Twitter, and you know you're basically joke writing. I'm curious about how you write them. Do they just come out like fully formed? Do you have to sit there and like noodle with it? Or do they just occur to you? Are you just somebody for whom these sort of funny thoughts are occurring? It's very simple and you just kind of put them up there and that's it? Or are you laboring over these jokes and trying to make sure you get the phrasings right? And do you see what I'm saying? Like, what's the process? What does the process look like for you? How much work are you putting into this?
So I have two accounts, and I have a Melissa Broder account, and I have tried to be precious and clever and joke. And, you know, I mean, for years, I was like, I want this to be like, you know, I want to be I'm going to make me a star. And like, it's fine. So Sad Today is literally vomit. And that's the one that people have responded to. So Sad Today, I don't craft. There's humor, but like, it's far less. I mean, so Sad Today started, like the origin, Brad knows this, but like I worked in an office. I was going through a cycle of particularly harrowing panic attacks with underlying depression, but I was afraid that I wasn't going to be able to like stay in the job. Like I wasn't going to be able to like keep my ass in the seat, literally. Like, so I just started kind of tweeting into the void and I didn't want to talk about this stuff on my personal account because it was so like, you know, I'm like, this is poetry, which I don't think it is, but I was more precious about it. So I just started randomly tweeting into the void. I followed like two weird tweeters. I loved Weird Twitter, RIP Weird Twitter. It's not the same now, but I followed like two weird tweeters, and I guess one of them followed me back and like retweeted me, and then that's how it all started. It was just like this sort of like empty vessel, and it was anonymous for years, right? Like I love the anonymity, but so I think what was once probably a creative impulse and maybe some sort of healthy coping mechanism or healthy-ish has now just turned into like my addiction to the dopamine. You know what I'm saying? And it's like my still like a refusal to feel all the feelings and but I mean, it's fine. I'm not going to pathologize it, but it is what it is. But I am like, I can't believe I'm still tweeting from this fucking account.
Hey, but, and this is my next question. Like, it's been a boon to your career, I have to believe, or at least it's a significant piece.
Yeah.
Like when we think about the modern media landscape, publishing, film and television, whatever it happens to be, like if you have a million Twitter followers, that's going to get people's attention. Like that, like to have that megaphone and to have the ability to reach that many people with, you know, your smartphone any time of day, you know, when it comes to the publication of a book or it comes to the adaptation of one of your books for the screen, I have to believe gatekeepers like consider that a positive. Like, has that been your experience of it? Or is that your conception of it?
Yeah. I mean, I think like in publishing, you know, I worked as a book publicist, before I moved to California. So I worked at Penguin as a book publicist for 10 years and I've been in California now for 7. So I haven't worked in publicity for 7, but even then we were talking about like, you know, does the author have a platform?
Right.
You know, do they have a platform?
Right.
And like, because of that word platform, you'll get like some like 60-year-old guy like signing up for Facebook the first time, like the night before his book comes out. And then like, you'll get the like, thank you for friending me. Here is my self-published book on, you know what I'm saying? Like the word plat, like I don't like the word content. I don't like the word platform. I hate the, you know what I hate? Creatives.
Yeah.
Creatives.
Yeah.
It's like they're creatives. I'm like, what does that even mean, creatives?
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that like I'm off. I'm semi-famously off social, like at least if you listen to this show. But I think that like for the rare person who's able to like go viral and really get like amass a following. Like if you amass a following, it works for you, you know, at least like you have the satisfaction of knowing that like your account and the time you've spent on Twitter have returned you. There's a return on your investment. Whereas like for the vast majority of people, the only people cashing in are like the
executives at Twitter.
Well, that's a whole other issue. But yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes I'm like, when the account, I think it just got 1 million followers like in 2020. I forget when it was, but it was like a couple months ago. And I had mixed feelings because part of me was like, oh my God, like this is cool. This is something I literally did completely myself. You know, it's just a voice, right? There's no tits. Like it's not, like it's, I did this with my voice and my depression and my like inability to like sit with myself. That's on the one hand. But then the flip side, I'm like, well, there's a lot of stupid shit that like amasses millions of followers. You know, like actually most things that have millions of followers are dumb. So it's mixed. But
but So Sad Today is like, it's art, I think. I mean, I think it's a kind of poetry and performance art or something. And
yeah, I mean,
and it's comedy. It's like dark comedy. Like it's a very, it's brilliant. You know, it's just one of these ideas that worked and it captures something about, I think, people's experience of life, but also their experience of online life.
It came from the heart. And I think the fact that it was anonymous allowed me a freedom that I could take off a mask because I was wearing the mask of anonymity, you know? So like if you work in an office, you know, it's like you wear these, I mean, in life, we all are wearing all these masks all the time. Right. Like, and when I put on the mask of anonymity, I was able to take off the other masks and talk about something that, and I even talked about this in the So Sad Today book that, you know, I have this account that's like, literally like, it's very focused on one element of a human, of a human's experience that others also identify with, which is this depression and fear. And Brad, I remember when I had a panic attack when you and I were out to lunch somewhere or we were working. I wrote about this in the So Sad Today book. I had a panic attack with you when you were like newly working together. And I was like, well, this means I can never have another one. And like, I would be at like an interview with a journalist about the So Sad Today book, scared that I was going to have a panic attack and that I would be judged, which is so bizarre because we're there talking about an account that's about anxiety and depression. But it's like there's something about the disembodied nature of a tweet that, especially when it's anonymous, it's not anymore, but it still has a pink avatar, it does in my face, that feels so much safer for me to reveal myself than the actual vulnerability of being a human being in a body who is powerless, you know, at times over her brain and her physiology.
Yeah, I consider it like, I mean, like, but like, you know, I remember that. I think we were in Venice. I want to say we were.
Yes. That day. And I was like, I gotta go.
Yeah, and I didn't know. I was like, I'm trying to like navigate. But like, I've always been moved by the, like the resilience of you who have been dealt some tough cards, like, you know, like dealing with addiction, dealing with food stuff, dealing with depression and anxiety and these panic attacks. Like you found a way to make it work for you. I feel some sense of triumph on your behalf that you were able to channel it into this thing that's reached so many people and makes people happy and laugh and makes them feel less alone. Like you could do worse. You know what I'm saying?
I could do worse.
Yeah. So I hope you see some of that. I hope you view it that way, at least partially.
I think that's going to be my new self-esteem mantra. I could do worse.
You could. You're doing great. You're doing great. And
thanks, Brad. I'm going to leave this feeling so good.
Do you see yourself continuing that Twitter feed for life? I feel like you almost have to. Like, I feel like it's your part of your legacy. Like that.
I mean, I don't want to.
It's a lot of work.
I'm addicted. No, it's not work. It's the opposite. Okay. So I have a new addiction and I'm in love with it. It's called Block Puzzle Game. Okay. Block Puzzle Game isn't a certain game. Block Puzzle Game is a type of game. If you search Block Puzzle Game on like iTunes or whatever, the store, you know, like the game store, it's free. It's like you'll get like 100 different types of these games. What it is it's sort of like Tetris, but like a menopausal version where there's no like time crunch. I'm obsessed. My sister came here for Christmas. She wanted a Sega for Christmas, like an old school Sega. We started playing Tetris. I was up all night playing it.
I love Tetris.
Oh, the orgasm. Okay. Get yourself some Block Puzzle Game. So now...
What is it? Is it on your phone? It's called...
Yeah, it's a phone game that's like a Tetris-y game.
Okay.
But it's just like a crap version. You know, it's like... There's a million different types. There's like wood or what... They call it... It's called Block Puzzle Game. I call it BPG.
Okay.
But block puzzle, yeah, there's like a bunch of them. It's a block puzzle game or puzzle block game. It's Tetris basically, but without the time and the, so it's like really soothing. It's like just like the feeling of breaking the blocks, but without the time crunch. It's like, I'm so deep in this shit. But now, so I like asked one of my mentors, I was like, okay, so I feel like the block puzzle's starting to like, you know, because I've been dealing with a lot of shit with my dad. Like, my dad's been in the ICU. Like, I was like, I feel like the block puzzle is definitely starting to be like take over my life a little bit. And she was like, Melissa, your dad's in the ICU. You have a book. Like, give yourself the block puzzle. And I was like, Rebecca says I can play the block puzzle, you know, with impunity. Well, fast forward a month. I can't do anything without the block puzzle now. When I hear the words block puzzle game, you know how like junkies describe that when they know they're going to be going to score, they already feel better. Right. All I have to do is hear the words block puzzle game and a narcotic calm comes over my body. But the point is, I think block puzzle probably stimulates some of the same dopamine receptors in my brain that Twitter does. So I think it's probably good. Well, not good. I think it's a nice distraction from the world of Twitter. Like I feel that it is hitting those same slot machines. But after I tweet, like there's a living thing in the world. Like at the end of block puzzle, like I'm always like, wait, there's nothing.
Right.
But it's kind of cool to be doing something that's not about.
It's like a mandala. It's like you create a beautiful mandala and then you blow it away, like blow all the sand away.
I blow, exactly. And so much of what I do, I feel like, is like so like achievement oriented and just like, how do I measure myself? And block puzzle, I feel like in the end may be healthy for me because it's like, I'm getting worse. I'm not getting better at this game. I also don't give a shit if I'm better. I just love the feeling of the blocks breaking. So this may either be the best or worst thing that ever happened to me. I haven't figured it out yet.
I mean, in the realm of things that are not good for us, I think block puzzle is probably lower on the hierarchy of toxic events, right?
Definitely. I mean, right. That's what we say. However, you know, when you find yourself like not able to have a conversation with a human being on the phone without block puzzle, it's like, you know, you're like, all right, I know my intent, right? I know what I'm using it for. I know where block puzzle has settled in.
Well, that's the thing though. And this is, I think,
about the block puzzle.
This is like, I think you're speaking to something right now that gets to the heart of why your work on Twitter and on the page resonates so well, is that you have such like a great degree of self-awareness. I think part of it is born from having been, you know, in sobriety for a long time and being in communities around sobriety where people talk about their insides openly, and in community, which is a rare experience among humans. I think maybe we talked about this last time you were on the show, like the envy that I can sometimes feel for people who have like that structure, you know, that kind of human structure to participate in, because, you know, everybody's struggling with one thing or another, whether it's substance or some other emotional upset. And to just have a group to go to where people are actually testifying honestly about really, really difficult stuff, I think gives you an education in your own stuff and in your own insides that would be difficult perhaps to access otherwise. And then on top of that, I think there's therapy. I think there's reading. I think some of it's just native intelligence and courage and like a willingness to sort of stare into the abyss or like, you know, sit with the darkness or whatever. But, you know, I think I've told you before, I've tried to like describe what you're doing. It's like you're kind of like a cartographer or like a map maker when it comes to human suffering. Like you're able to map the terrain. But you do it also with humor, which I think is critical. Because it's like that spoonful of sugar, you know, it's like if you were just talking about suffering accurately, but without the humor, people might be like, oh, well, she's right. But like, damn, that's heavy. You know, like, I think the humor is a way to digest, you know, since we're on the topic of food. But I don't know, like, I think like that, like, am I hitting close to anything that feels like a target? Like, maybe it's harder. Maybe it's hard for you to see or easy for you to see. But I think people who appreciate your work, hopefully they would get what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's like, I never talk about, like the I'm very open about my sobriety. I never talk about like my recovery modalities publicly. But I always say like, and so sad day, I'm like, if you want to email me, I'll talk to you more about it. But I feel like just a reverence for like the people and processes and the ways that I got and stay sober. And so I really respect like the tradition of sort of that I am not a representative of that. Right. Like that. So I wish I could talk about that. Well, I don't really wish I could talk about that, but, you know, let's just say my sober life, like my life in that realm has been the richest gift of my life, you know, and continues to be the richest gift of my life. And has absolutely had an impact, on the ability to be honest, my ability to be honest with others and with myself. You know, I'll say that.
Well, and I hope I didn't breach anything. I tried to talk. You know, it's always like a language challenge.
It's when fine. Others have done worse.
Yeah. You know, I just, it's like,
you did good.
Oh yeah. I'm just trying to like tap dance.
Yeah, and, did good.
But I think you've done the work, you know, I think like,
well, the work's never over.
I know, but I'm just saying that like somebody who's able to write about the struggle and human suffering and food issues and whatever it is, you know, whatever, you know, constellation of human struggles that you're dealing with, like you really have gone in there and grappled with it. And I think you work harder and try harder than maybe you sometimes let on or even admit to yourself. But that's something I really admire about you is like, you've been through a lot, but you have a lot of courage and you've like faced down a lot of stuff and you do the work like on an ongoing basis. It's not like it's done, but like, mm-hmm. I don't know. I sense a lot of fight in you that you might not necessarily always give yourself credit for. So I'm giving mm-hmm. I'm giving you credit for it.
Yeah. I mean, against my, like, looking back, it appears that I have repeatedly, despite my best efforts otherwise, it appears that I have continued to choose the light or choose, I mean, I don't want to make it a binary, but choose to stay alive, choose to, you know, not, and I have no judgment against choosing otherwise, you know, or being caught and forced to choose otherwise, you know, but it does. Yes. Looking back, I'm like, wow. Like actually I had a tweet about this. I was like, oh, like if sixth grade me saw me now, she'd be like, you're still alive. You know, like it baffled that's what I'm trying to say. Like it baffles me, you know? But, and yes, I do pretend to, I don't like to show how much effort I put into things, namely because, a fear of rejection. Like if I show you that I invested and then I am rejected, all of that investment is being rejected. But if I pretend that it's casual and messy, then you're just rejecting something. Now, technically it's the same rejection. So it's really just a game I'm playing with myself, but it's like why, so I have this like dumb little podcast thing. I don't call it a podcast. I call it a show, but I call it a shodcast. Cause I like didn't, you were like a podcast, you know, you were a podcast pioneer. I was like, you know, I didn't want to be one of the fucking people in 2017 who was like, oh, it's my podcast. But, so I call it a show, but, it's why I don't use a microphone. It's why I record like shittily in my car and never, I don't want an audio engineer. Cause I'm like, I don't want to try. If I try and it doesn't, and it's shit, then I'm like, oh, well, I tried and it's shit. But this way I'm like, oh, honey, like the shit is intentional. Like
it's yeah. I think like, yeah.
So Brad encouraged me to buy a microphone for this show. And because I deeply respect Brad, I bought a microphone.
I have been evangelizing.
I might actually turn it after I'm done. You I'm might. Just that kind of bitch. Yeah.
No, I think you should keep it. I've been evangelizing for this, like for most of the pandemic. I think for authors, especially in the age of COVID, when everything is done remotely, if you have a microphone and if you're doing media for a book, for example, and you get like a microphone for like whatever it is, $125 or something, the podcast interviews that you do sound so much better and more people will listen. It's like just a good, like sound business investment. It'll come in handy.
We'll see. Well, here's the thing. I might have to keep it because I bought it online at Target. And when I entered my email, I wrote melissabroder@gmail.com. So they never emailed me the receipt. And I was on with customer service. So I might not have a receipt. So see, I might be keeping that.
I have condemned you. I have condemned you. I have condemned you to owning a microphone. I'm sorry.
gmail.com. The guy, like, I'm like on the phone with customer service and I'm like really PMS right now. So I was like not being as nice as I would like to be. Like I was just a little curt. Like I was like, excuse me, I didn't receive my online receipt. And they're like, well, let's check the, oh, melissabroder@gmail.com. And I was like, fuck. So
I am probably my worst version of myself on an angry customer service call. Like when I feel there's been an injustice or I'm frustrated. If I've been on hold for like 40 minutes, like waiting to get my fucking frequent flyer shit figured out, like I can be a person that I think if the average listener bore witness to it, they would like, I would be canceled. I'd never be listened to again. You know, like I think maybe we all have those moments, but like, what is it about customer service? I think it's maybe the impersonality of it.
And it's like that pent up, like, finally, there is a human being. And you know, technically, you know that human being on the other line. First of all, you know they're a human being with suffering and pain and all. Number two, you know they have absolutely no control over what has just gone wrong. However, it's like, I have an audience.
Yes.
Like, I've hitched, the boat has hitched. Like, if you're on a boat and you're like, the boat is like amiss and being like tossed to sea, you know, and the boat, and you're like, when you hit shore, you're going to like respond to the people who greet you on the shore. Like, even if it wasn't their fault that your ship got fucked up, like you're going to have a pretty desperate response, you
right,
know?
Right, right.
That desperation.
I found myself on those calls in the past where like, I guess I, like you could call it like breaking the fourth wall, where I'll be like bitching. And then suddenly I'll be like, I'll get self-aware and I'll be like, and listen, I know that this isn't your fault. I know that you're just the customer service representative who is hired to absorb the like anger, the righteous anger of people like me. And that the people who are truly responsible, the executives in your company, are using you as a human shield. And I'll say shit like that. And then like, I'll sometimes get like a little bit of affirmation from the cut. Like they'll laugh or they'll be like, okay, because you know they're being recorded. They can't say anything, and I'll try I'm trying to like goad them into somehow turning on their higher ups or something. But the human shield,
destroying their life.
I feel bad for them. Like I feel like
human shield. No, but you're. I mean,
that's true kinda. Though. It's true. Like the people who actually make the kinds of decisions that make like a customer experience truly hellish never have to actually engage with the customers that they're abusing. And they insulate themselves with people that they pay a pittance to sort of sit there all day long, you know, dealing with this. And I don't know. I find the whole thing ghoulish. And I, you know, like I said, it lowers me as a human being.
You know, it's ugly. It's ugly when you find yourself being ugly to a stranger who you know. But sometimes it's like that ball of rage, you know, and the entitlement, right? Or like the self. But I mean, you know, sometimes like, I don't know. I mean, like often and like, you know, whatever. I was like, Target, you need to rectify this shit.
That's what I'm saying. This injustice cannot stand. Like,
well, then, and I heard the person like checking, like trying to type in what my problem was into the computer. It's kind of like, you know, when you ask someone for directions and you realize within like 30 seconds that they don't know where it is either, but they're going to give it their best shot. And you're like, you just talk about a human shield. You're like, never mind. Like, I don't need you. But you're like, oh, now I got to listen to this person. Give me like think about it.
Yes,
you know, like,
yes.
Yeah.
And try to like look at Google Maps and advise you and, you know.
And it's like, honey.
Okay. I want to ask you about Judaism and spirituality. Like you talked a little bit about this earlier, but I think it bears going into further because it's a big part of your book. And I think it's probably the most surprising part. Based on our personal history, like the food stuff, the sex part of your book, like those themes, like it didn't catch me off guard at all. I know that's like sort of your wheelhouse. But Judaism, I mean, I obviously know that you're Jewish and were raised Jewish, but you know, the Miriam character is Orthodox, which for those, out there who are not versed in Judaism is like a different, it's like a different level of Judaism, you know. It's a, like you said, like there's a certain kind of dress code that is observed, and it's like a stricter
you know, lifestyle than like the Reform Jew or whatever. You could speak to this better than I. But the Rachel character in her relationship with Miriam is exploring her Judaism in a sincere and serious way in the book. And I would imagine you were doing the same, you know, in writing it and kind of examining these characters. And I just like to hear you talk. Like you said a little bit earlier, you know, earlier that you had sort of been like feeling an unexpected or new nostalgia for the Judaism or the Jewish experiences of your youth with your grandparents. And I just like to hear you talk a bit more about that and like where you stand with Judaism now and what's your understanding of it and how you relate to it.
Sure. So my upbringing was definitely more similar to Rachel's than to Miriam's. Like I was much more of what I would call like a mall Jew rather than a Talmud Jew, you know, like I had a bat mitzvah, but it was like my bat mitzvah. Like when I think bat mitzvah, my word association is like Claire Antonini, like got to second with my like crush. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think about like the spirituality of like, it didn't feel super spiritual. You know, I was just upset that like somebody hooked up with my crush. So, and I think as I've gotten older, like, I don't think I'm a particularly religious, I'm not a religious Jew. And I don't think I'm a particularly necessarily, I don't have one religion. Like I'm very much of the belief that like truth is one and paths are many, which I think is Swami Satchidananda, I think said that. So my spiritual life, which I do have a very rich spiritual life, but it consists of rituals that are cobbled together from a variety of traditions. It's very American. It's like a smorgasbord. But there's another quote that's basically like, I don't know who said this, but it's basically like saying like, you know, all the rabbis and the mystics and the priests are all pointing their finger at the same moon. But like, we want to cling to the finger, right? Like we get so focused on the finger. And I think in my 20s, I was definitely like a big finger clinger. Like I was sort of frantically searching outside myself for like this wholeness. And I was like, any psychic or any like astrologer knows more than I do. You know, like I want to fix this broken thing, which is myself. And I thought that spirituality was like, I really imagined it as like, I'm on a lotus and like, I'm over here. And like, I feel like I'm on some good, like heroiny ecstasy and I can't be hurt. And I think that I'm still a seeker, but it's not really like a frantic quest to fix something broken. Like it's more of like an exploratory gathering and kind of like trying different fingers that point me to the moon. I also don't feel like spirituality is necessarily that like the expectation that I'm going to just like be able to live on the moon. Right. It's more about like, wait, actually like becoming more okay with being a human, you know, and all the imperfections that that entails. So, but when it comes to these fingers, right, like the Jewish laws and the archetypes of God, like have always felt like they have never really super resonated with me. Like I'm not a huge fan of Yahweh. Like he feels very punishing. I feel like I've worked very hard to conceptualize like a higher power for myself or not conceptualize, like deconceptualize a punishing God, right? And just let it be a mystery and like that it's not somebody I have to please or who's like a cosmic judge.
I feel the exact same way about the Catholic God of my youth, you know, that kind of dogma of my youth. It never resonated, and yet I believed it to an extent because I was a kid and the adults in my world were telling me this stuff.
Yes.
But I've spent my whole adult life trying to sort of reconfigure that, I think.
I mean, it's a great, and that's sort of in some ways my perspective, not perspective, but I feel like so much for me of like what spirituality, if you want to like use that word, is like an unlearning, not just of like religious beliefs, but like of any of the things that, these ideas in the self that are, I think our parents are our first gods, right? And they do the best they can, but they definitely, there's a liturgy there, right? And there's like religions that get imparted. And there's a lot of things that I thought were true about the world that, or were truth, that were actually just opinions. And
like what? Can you think of something? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but is there an example of something big that like, you know,
well, I mean, I think this book contends a lot with the question of certitude. And, you know, I mean, Rachel's mother raises her believing that she has to be skinny in order to be worthy of love. I mean, that is like, right, you know, and that is an experience that I also had growing up, you know, where it really was the religion of my mother's religion, you know, that the body, that love was contingent on appearances. And I don't think I've fully unlearned that yet. I mean, I don't know if you can, but what I have done is I have discovered and uncovered that that is not the truth, that that is a perspective. And I think that in itself can be liberating. And maybe sometimes it's just the best we can do, you know, is to realize, oh, that's just a perspective. That is not the unequivocal truth.
So you talk about spirituality. We touched delicately on like how sobriety might factor into your spiritual life in practice,
yeah.
Maybe not in theory as much as in practice, you know, the human
yeah.
part of it. And then, like, can you talk about like how else you build? I know you're a meditator. That's like part of it, I would imagine. I guess you would qualify that as a spiritual activity.
Yeah, I think so.
Like, it's like, I kind of get the idea of like piecemealing it. Like you pick, like from a buffet, like things that, like little pieces that work for you that feel right. And then you build like a mode of living that helps to support you and maybe helps you like remember the finger pointing at the moon or remember the moon. You know
yes,
what I'm saying?
Every day it takes, you got every day. I forget the fucking moon. Every day I forget that it's an inside job. I think that something outside of me is going to be some shiny thing is going to be the thing. I don't wake up like being like, oh, I'll just go to God. You know, like I wake up being like, I'm going to go to Twitter and I'm going to make this happen. And I am going to blah, blah, blah. And I'm driven by fear of like not enoughness. Right. And, what I call, or what I've heard called, like the God-shaped hole, right? Like the hole that like there is no amount of anything that's going to fill it. But actually, when I like just go in there, when I just sit, it's actually not so bad. And sometimes it feels pretty nice in there, but I forget that it's not a horrible place to be, you know. And I think meditation is a reminder of that, because I watch a lot of thoughts go by, and then sometimes at the end I have some respite.
Right.
Sometimes I don't. But but sometimes I do. I think it also, meditation for me builds in pause. It builds in, like if I can meditate in the morning before I go on the internet, it's just a different way of going about things. I'm a little less reactive, you know?
Yeah, no. I think a couple thoughts that come to mind, because I meditate too, is that
I know,
like,
you're a meditator.
People, I think sometimes think they're doing it wrong because they're having thoughts. That's not the point. Like, you know, you're not supposed to like stop all thought. I mean, I guess that you can have these pauses, or maybe if you get really good, you know, you can get concentrated and quiet. But for the vast majority of people, you know, it's about observing thoughts. And then this idea of forgetting, like. It's just unbelievable to me how quickly and consistently I forget that I'm alive. I forget what I'm doing. I will go for a hike and I'll spend the entire hike in some sort of mental melodrama. And then I'll get back to my car to drive home and I'll be like, did I just hike? Like, what the fuck is going on? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you have these experiences where you get totally sidetracked, and it's a daily thing. Like, it's not like a one-time or a two-time or a 12-time thing. Like, you have to, or at least I think most human beings have to constantly work to, like, recalibrate and remind. I have to remind myself that, like, I'm not my mind. Like, the chattering insanity in my head is not me. I don't know. Like, it's just.
No, that's 100. That is my experience also, right?
Yeah,
you don't just, like, buy the ticket and then you arrive and, like, that's it. You know, it's why ritual exists, right? It's like why people daven daily, or why people meditate daily, or any ritual, right?
Yeah.
You don't just like, I wish there was a pill.
Yeah.
Believe me.
Yeah.
I would
right.
Love it.
Yeah. I know. And it just feels like, it feels like hygienic to me at this point. Like,
I think I've
seen the mess of my own head enough that I'm like, oh, okay. And I know that, like, when I meditate, it feels like I kind of, it's like flossing, you know, it's like, I should probably do this because it's just such a disaster up there. But when I do this, it's like cleaning it up a little bit. And it kind of feels like if I'm not, it's like, it would be like not brushing your teeth, you know, just being like, eh, I'm not going to do this anymore. Like, that's kind of how I think of it. But
yeah, 100%. I mean, it's not like I'm meditating and I'm like, oh, I'm so spiritual. Like, I'm meditating and I'm enlightened. No, it's just like when I don't do it, things are shittier.
Right. And like, it's like I have
not
food.
Things are so great. But yeah. I haven't arrived. But it's like when I don't, I'm like, oh, that's why I do.
Right. And I'm
that's
like,
why
I'm like more short-tempered. I'm more of a dick to my wife and my kids. I feel more depressed. And it's like, it's, and again, it's not like by some huge percentage. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, the improvements that it yields in my life are like small but noticeable, you know?
Yes.
Like, and I like to think that there's like some accrued benefit over time with consistency, that like maybe I'm inching like ever so slightly every day towards, you know, some higher version of myself or something. But it's like a long, it's like a long haul practice kind of thing. I also happen to think that it's really synchronous with like a writing life or a creative life. Like, the two things do go together nicely. You sort of have to sit down and stop and be still and sort of deal with that mind and the uncertainty and just kind of sit in the discomfort. That's writing, right? I mean, it's the same shit, but just different contexts.
Well, yeah. And it's like, you know, the ocean, right? It's like the top of the ocean can be choppy. Like, a lot of times I'm meditating and like the top of the ocean's still choppy. Like, I still got a lot of thoughts, but like, I become conscious that there actually is a depth under there too, at the same time, like they can coexist. And so writing from that deeper place, in my experience, is always going to be richer than like writing from the surface of the ocean. So yeah, I think it's really beneficial. And you know, there's like a lot of metaphors about that, right? Like, they talk about like the pond, like, you know, you toss a pebble into a still pond and like you see the ripples. But if the pond's like fucking chaotic, then like you're not gonna see any ripples.
Right.
No, definitely. And also, there's this poet, Muriel Rukeyser, she's dead, but she said the role of the poet, she's like, you just have to be a scarecrow for poems to land on. And I see that as the same as prose, right? And it's like, if you're not getting still enough for the stuff to land, how's it gonna land?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. Like, for whatever reason, I think maybe there's something about like divesting yourself from belief systems. Like, you talked about, you know, this notion of Yahweh or all these different kind of conceptions that we were handed as kids, and wanting to sort of deconstruct all that and get away from belief, like not only religious belief, but like too many beliefs in general. Like, I get suspicious of myself whenever I catch myself in the fever of like really strong belief. I don't know if you feel that way. Like, sometimes you'll be like, yes, like this is the way things are and I'm so right. And, you know, you feel all this passion, and then like, I'll go to sleep and wake up the next day and be like, I'm such an asshole. Like, is that even real? You know, like, it just never turns out well. And I think that something about meditation that works for me is you don't have to believe anything. And I think just the very fact that what you're doing is sitting down and shutting the fuck up and not moving. Like, that is a radical act, especially in the culture that we live in today. And it just makes total sense to me. Like, A, that it would be difficult, but also that it would be like beneficial and possibly, for certain people anyway, like necessary. You know, like, that's how I feel about it in my own context. Like, just sit the fuck down for 20 minutes a day, even, you know, or hopefully more. But I mean, like, that alone, like, it's got to be good for you.
Sometimes it's delicious.
Oh, it's the best. Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's delicious. Because, so my practice, I think the last time I was on the show was probably when the Pisces came out, like 3 years ago. And I always did the Melissa Broder method of meditation, which was like a bunch of stuff cobbled together from like YouTube videos and stuff like that. And then And I'm on this gratitude list. So I have some friends from New York. Like every day we like email each other some shit we're grateful. I mean, sometimes we do, sometimes we forget, but we're shit we're grateful for. And like for years, some of my friends on that list were like writing like, they're like, yeah, transcendental meditation. And I was like, fuck these bitches with their designer meditation, like paying for their med. And I was like so resentful. I was like so, I hate, I was like, ugh, the designer. And then like a couple of years ago, it was around my birthday, like 2 years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago, I was like, well, I pay a lot of money on my hair, so like maybe it would be okay to like enrich my spiritual education a little more and pay some money for it. And I did the TM thing, like, and so I've been doing, so my meditation practice, I mean, I've been meditating for a long time, but it sort of it slightly shifted gears, I guess, like 2 or 3 years ago. And as I said, I am definitely of the belief that like truth is one, paths are many. Like I think there's a million different great meditation modalities. What I like about TM for myself is that everything's okay. You know what I'm saying? It's like the thoughts kind of, that's okay. You feel like there's always all these questions, you know, we're asking like, well, this happened, or is it okay? It's all okay. And my mind is not a mind that my first thought is everything's okay. It's all good. I'm the opposite. So I didn't need like a critical. And also I have found, oddly, which this was not something I was not expecting this, but, and I think it's just because I meditate more now, because in TM you do like about 20 minutes in the morning and you do 20 minutes in the afternoon or evening, which for me ends up being like 15 and then like 15 at like midnight, like as I'm like eating a protein bar, but you know, ideally, but is the fact that I'm meditating for more time now, I think has definitely has influenced my, like my physiology. Like it really helped me with my panic attacks. Like I never was able to drink coffee or caffeine. And now that I have TM, I have the beautiful drug of caffeine back in my life.
Oh,
which
interesting.
Is, yeah. So I do feel like something, and I don't know if that's because of TM or, I mean, I don't believe that it's this magical modality. I think it has to do with that I have a mantra, and I think any mantra can be helpful in quieting the mind. And I also think just that I'm meditating more now daily. I think that had a big...
I think the second, because I try to do 2 times a day, the second one I find, just because of the circumstances of life and kids and stuff, is harder. I get carried away with work, and the second one's harder to sit down. The morning one is like you can get to the cushion, and I will sit in the morning. Like I've been getting up really early and then have been sitting for like 45 minutes. Like I try to do, I do like both basically of my sits in one, just because it fits into my life better. But I think there's something to be said for getting caught up in the flow of your work life and your just daily existence and all of the frenetic nature of it online, and you're talking and you're having calls and you're doing podcasts, and then taking the time on the back half of the day to stop. Like the act of stopping and sitting on that cushion is hard for me. Like I'll find myself like, you feel that inner resistance to it, but
definitely.
I think when you do it, like I have no science to back this up, but it makes sense to me that if you can get into the regular habit of doing the twice daily sit, you know, separated by several hours, that it's going to have a nice effect on your nervous system in the way that you just described, because you know, it's just like, you know, you do your sit in the morning and then you get caught up in the day and your nervous system gets ratcheted back up. And if you do that second sit, then you're going to hopefully take some of that edge off and you're going to get the benefit. It's going to even you out over a greater portion of your life and your waking life, especially. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah, for sure. I also like to think of it a little bit as magic too, right? Like I like the magic. I want the magic. Give me the magic, you know, I'm just kind of like, I never like, with alcohol and drugs, I wasn't like looking up like the science of like, you know, like I didn't want to know the science. I was like, this is fucking magic. So like, I want that magic, you know, but yes, I 100% agree. I think the pause is magic. A shift in perception is magic.
And I feel like, you know, I think in like the Buddhist or Hindu or whatever cosmology that meditation seems to flow from, there's lots of magic. Like I'm such a sucker for these stories of these fucking gurus in India. Like I don't, like I read about Neem Karoli Baba like on like a quarterly basis because I'm just so fascinated by the anecdotes about him. Have you ever read about him?
Yes.
Like where people like go up to him and he's like,
you stole a cupcake from the bakery, you know, yesterday, and you were thinking about your mom. And then, like, people just, like, burst into tears. And it's like, he just, like, he could read people's minds. And, like, yeah. I'm so fascinated by it because the stories are consistent from person to person to person. Like, it's the same fucking thing. And it's to the point where, like, a skeptic like me is like, how can this many people be wrong? You know, like, there's shit going on in this world and in this universe that is not observable by me, you know, at least. I can't see it. There's just more than meets the eye. And certain rare people are tapped into that magic. And I'm willing to believe that. And it makes life more exciting to me to think that it's possible.
Yeah, I mean, the one, the Atman, the collective, right? The collective unconscious. Like, if Neem Karoli Baba's tapped into that, like, you're not reading minds, you're reading mind, right? It's,
yeah,
like, one. And, oh, of course, and yes, like, I mean, you know, Pickle, my dog, like, can hear a dog whistle that I can't hear, you know? So there's probably a lot we don't perceive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Groovy.
Like, what about, but like, while we're on this topic, like, I don't know if we talked about this on your previous guest appearances, but why am I blanking on the woman's name, the hugging saint?
Amma,
yeah. Do you still go, I guess, like, in the age of COVID, poor Amma can't be out hugging people.
No, Amma did not go on tour this past summer. But
you would go if circumstances were different, you would be there.
Yeah, I love it. It's so juicy.
Okay.
It's so good when I'm around Amma.
Do you really think she's a saint? Like, is it authentic or is it like projection? Like, do you know what I'm saying? How do you read your own experience of Amma? And for those of you listening who don't know who she is, she's like, and I want to say she's an Indian Hindu, like, considered like a living saint. And she goes around the world and she holds these events where she hugs anyone in attendance who wants a hug. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And you've been hugged by her.
I've been hugged, but even years before I got the hug, I would just go sit because I'm such a fucking junkie and I would glom on. I would get this vibe, man. I would feel high in her presence. And it's weird because I found her the first year I was sober. And also through, it's like a whole long thing, but I guess that was, yeah, 16 years ago. And I remember the first time I was around her, I was I hated it. I was like, fuck all these like white assholes with like, you know, cause it's just like this like coterie of like a lot of, I mean, it's people of all ethnicities and races, but like, you know, there's like a lot of like annoying, like white people, you know, just like selling crystals. Cause there's like a whole bazaar that follows her. And all the money goes to her organizations. But like, I didn't know that, you know, I'm just like, who are these clowns with like the fucking, like, you know, whatever. But, and then, so I'm sitting there and then like, I had this moment and it was like, I heard this voice and it was like, God loves all the children the same, no matter where we are on the path. And then all of a sudden I like went like whoosh. And I felt really serene. I would describe it. At the time I described it as high. And I was scared I'd gotten dosed. I didn't know what had happened to me. And I think it was
I got to stop you. You heard a voice in your head say this?
Yes. Yeah. I wrote a poem about that.
What did the voice sound like?
I guess it's like a still small voice, probably maybe my own voice, but not mine.
Okay. Okay. I didn't
well,
know.
Mine and not mine.
It didn't
not
sound like
it, my
it,
ego.
It didn't sound like Charlton Heston, I guess is what I was like.
It sounded like B. Arthur. Who I think would be an incredible god.
Yes. I'm much better than Charlton Heston. So, okay.
It was probably my own innate wisdom that we all have, right? Like, again, we talk about this, like I believe it's already in us, right? And like these teachers, like Amma's, I think, a spiritual genius, right? Like she's a genius teacher. Amma is a spirit. Like you asked if I think she's a saint. I think like saint is another word for spiritual genius. There are musical geniuses who can conjure like, deep feelings of reverence and spirituality and ecstasy in us, right? And I think Amma is able to do that through philanthropy and also through her own refining of like her own meditation practices, right? Like Amma's a deep meditator. Amma's a deep prayer. Amma has practiced. Like she is, it's like John Coltrane with the saxophone, right? Like John Coltrane was born probably very, very, very gifted. Amma was probably born very spiritually gifted, but both of them had to practice, you know, and they continue to practice every day. I mean, John Coltrane was never not playing a saxophone. So that is what I think. And
I agree. I think so too. I think like that's a great way of like languaging it, is that it's like an instrument and some people have like natural talent, but you still have to do the work. And I think too, like there's often something simple. Like I just think, I think about Amma just giving people hugs. There's something so radical about that, you know, like that simple act. And like making,
you should come with me just to see what the deal is.
I'll go anytime. I mean, as soon as this COVID bullshit is over, let's do it. I'm there. I'll go get a hug from Amma.
And it's interesting. Like, I mean, you know, I brought Nikki, my husband, who's just not wired like that way. He's not a non-believer, but like, he's kind of like an agnostic pantheist vibe, but used to be more of an atheist, I think, when he went, like more convinced there was nothing. Now I think he's less convinced that there's nothing. So I'd say he's more of an agnostic. I don't know how you can be convinced that there is or isn't.
Right.
So I brought him, and I remember like he didn't feel the vibe at all. Like he was like, he was very respectful. He was just like sitting in the back. It was at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York. They used to do it. And he was just like sitting in the balcony, like eating a donut, reading the New Yorker, chilling, you know, and I'm like fucking like, I'm like so high off this vibe. Like I almost have vertigo, you know, and he's just like chilling. So I think it's different because I do think we contain it within us, you know, and to say it's Amma alone is to just look at the finger, right? Like, it's what she calls up, you know, what that is her gift, what she's able to bring, that love that exists. I believe in all of us, you know.
Wow. Well, I guess like a good way to close would be to ask about like film and TV stuff. Like you've got an adaptation of The Pisces in the works. This Milkfed has been optioned as well. You're writing the scripts for these.
Yeah.
So you adapt your own stuff. Like, can you just talk a little bit about what the status of those projects is? And then also if you're, you know, I'm assuming you're working on another book. You're so productive. I imagine you have like three novels like in your phone somewhere.
Just one.
Okay.
So I have, so I wrote a couple years ago the screenplay for The Pisces, and now that is being produced. I wrote it for Lionsgate, and Lionsgate paired me with a woman who's a great producer named Anne Carey out of New York. When Lionsgate changed, like, executives or whatever, I don't know, there's like always Hollywood shifts, we basically like took it back from them because we didn't think they were going to make it. So now Anne's production company brought on Gillian Robespierre to direct it, and Claire Foy is going to star. And we're casting Theo now, but I can't talk about that. So I am just a screenwriter on that. So I have like no control really over anything.
Will you do a cameo? Will you be like on the beach in Venice, like in the background eating an ice cream cone or something?
That would actually be cool. I didn't even think about it. I would prefer Pickle to be in it. Just want Pickle to be in it.
Okay.
But no, that could be cool. Maybe I will. Maybe. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Like sort of Hitchcock, you know, like just like walk through the background somewhere.
Well, I don't, but see, the thing is, I'm not a producer. The screenwriter, once you've written the screenplay, there's an Alberto Moravia book called Contempt, and his description of being a screenwriter is like the fucking best, because he's just like they don't need you. Like they do, but then they don't, you know. And so it's very, they'll tell me things that are happening because they don't want me to hate the movie. Like they don't want me in Entertainment Weekly, like I, you know, not like to be like talking shit because I wrote the book and the screenplay, but you know, but like I it's not in my control anymore.
Right.
None of it's in my control. So it's like vaya con Dios. But with Milkfed, I am a producer, which is interesting. I mean, I'm a producer right now of nothing because it hasn't gone anywhere yet. But ostensibly, I was hired by ABC Signature, which is a studio for these lovely women, Stacey and Liz, who have Best Day Ever, their production company with ABC. They hired me, they like optioned the book and hired me to write the pilot. So I wrote the pilot. So now we're doing the whole, we're going to be taking it out soon.
So like as a limited series?
As a full series.
Like for seasons, like going on.
For seasons, baby.
Whoa. But like,
but again, we're talking about nothing right now because it doesn't have a home yet, but ostensibly.
Like, but it would be milk fed and it would just be like an extrapolation of this world and these characters.
Yes.
Interesting. And then what about the next novel?
And it's like, right. And you asked what it's like writing about your own stuff. It's like writing fanfic, you know, about your own characters.
Right. Right. You're like, what can we do with them?
Like, why just put them in this situation?
And then you're working on another novel.
Yes. I'm working on another novel that I wrote actually the first couple drafts of before Milk Fed, and then was sort of working on Milk Fed kind of at the same time, and then like realized the novel was a piece of shit and not something I wanted to take out. And so worked really hard on Milk Fed for like another 9 months and then took Milk Fed out instead. But so I am like, I tore it up. I realized like there's a little germ of the novel that had been in the drawer that like is coming into this new version that I'm writing, but it's very, very different. But I'm basically tearing something apart and putting it back together, and hopefully I'll like it, but I don't know yet.
It'll congeal.
Yeah, we're gonna find out.
All right. Well, you are you're killing it. I'm happy to talk to you and to see you. I know you've had a rough go. You mentioned earlier your dad being in the ICU. Yeah. I know that he's had, you know, he had a car accident and has been, you know, in a serious health situation. So I know that like a book launch on its own can be stressful. And then you have all this Hollywood shit and then you have personal and family stuff. So
yeah,
it's a lot at once. And on top of it, I forced you to get this fucking microphone and you did that.
And I couldn't even spell my email right. The microphone was the last straw. My dad in the ICU for 9 weeks. Coding, having to be resuscitated, no big deal. The microphone.
Melissa, if I could just get you,
gonna push you over the edge.
If I could just get you to go to Target in the middle of a once-in-a-century pandemic to purchase this microphone so that our podcast could sound a little bit better, I would appreciate it.
It's just a it's just, listen, I was like, when you texted me the other day to be like, hey, Friday, right? I was like, oh, fuck. I didn't get the microphone. And I was like, I'm going to get so much trouble. And then I was like, because I respect you, Brad. I respect your audio quality very deeply. And I respect your respect for audio quality.
Hey, I'm trying to do right by my listeners. And if we're going to do this and it's going to live online in perpetuity, it might as well sound good, right?
Listen, I want whatever you want. Whatever makes you happy, I now have this microphone.
Me caring for the audio quality of this conversation is my equivalent of the Ama hug. This is how I express my love for the universe, is to try to deliver good audio.
You want to hug people's ears.
Yes, correct. Well, I'm happy for you. And
always a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm glad to talk with you, and I think this book is wonderful. It's also like, people should know too, like, it's a great love story. Like, it's a romantic book, and it's got a sweet heart to it, and it's funny, and all the, you know, it's got all the things that people love about Melissa Broder in it. So I think you're gonna find a lot of people responding to it well. So congratulations.
Thank you so much, Brad.
All right, there you have Melissa Broder. Her new novel is called Milk Fed. It is out there from Scribner as we speak. You can find Melissa online at melissabroder.com. You can follow her on Twitter. Her handle is at Melissa Broder. You can also follow at So Sad Today. Again, the novel is called Milk Fed. Go get your copy immediately. It's got a big boob on the cover. Can't miss it. It's an artfully, tastefully rendered breast. Mammary. Melissa Broder, Milk Fed. Great time talking with her. As always. The Other People podcast was launched in 2011. It's been around for almost a decade. It is offered freely, nearly 700 episodes and counting. It's a listener-supported program. If you like the program, support the program. Tip your server. You can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod for as little as a dollar a month. You know, it's easy. patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you have something to say to me, you can email me. The show's email address is letters@otherppl.com. letters@otherppl.com.
This program has its own official app. It, too, is free. The Other People with Brad List, the app, is available wherever you get your apps. If you would like to get some merchandise, Other People t-shirts, sweatshirts, a onesie for your child, you can do that. Just go to the show's website at otherppl.com. Click on the t-shirt in the left sidebar. Purchase some apparel. Coming up next week on the program, who do I have? My God, I don't even know. Let me see here. The tension is mounting. Will there be another episode of the Other People podcast? I believe it's going to be Vesna Marek. And you got to forgive me if I'm screwing up the pronunciation of that name. I'm still in the process of verifying. Vesna Marek, author of the novel The President Shop, which I just finished. All right? Okay, I think that wraps it up. The music's over. I'm out of here. Oh, wait. It wasn't over. It's never over until it's over. Okay, now it's over.